Many people like to use squats and gait analysis and toe touches and all sorts of complex movements in order to assess their patients and clients. What we're going to talk about today is how to actually use those, what those tests are showing you, and much more, all on this week's episode of
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking, and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Okay. So last time we talked about table assessments, we talked about the assessment course that Bill has put together. Part of the assessment course, outside of doing table tests and interpreting table tests, is complex movements. So we're going to talk about which are the main movements that we use and why. And then I think a lot of people like to talk about gait analysis and watching walking and being able to determine what's going on by walking. And I think if we kind of talk about that and look at it from the perspective of the UHPC model, it will clear a lot of things up for some people, or maybe let them understand that the things that they were looking at were probably not that important or incorrect. Okay. So let's just talk about the main movements that we would use in complex movements and what they sort of, what they tell us. And maybe compare that to, like, we can compare it to like legacy perspectives or models and why that might not be the whole picture.
Okay. First, let's emphasize whether you do table tests or not, you should probably understand them.
Sure.
Because what they provide is an understanding of how these external rotations and internal rotations are produced by the shape of the structure itself. And so that's kind of important, because what we're going to do is we're going to take those potential changes, and then we're going to change the context. So instead of having this constraint of the table that helps us manage these things in emphasis, it's like we're emphasizing an upper extremity versus a lower extremity, what those represent. Now we're going to take the whole system. We're going to say, okay, I'm going to put you upward against gravity. I'm going to have you perform an activity that we can, I hesitate to use the word standardized, but again, we're going to use it as a comparator, which is the great value of complex movements, because we can see differences in befores and afters, but we have to understand what those shapes represent and what the changes would represent. So we can limit our approach by selecting out some specific movements that are a little bit easier to see. Ultimately, what we would want to be able to do is take any movement, because all movements are complex when we're moving upright against gravity, right? So in this circumstance, you can just take some of your typical complex movements like toe touches and squats and split squats, turning, whether it be like a seated or a standing rotation or something to that effect, because each of those elements of the propulsive cycle are all represented in those activities. Somewhere both sides appear to be doing the same thing at the same time, and some that are obviously more asymmetrical, like your turns and your split squats. Yeah. And so we use those to compare. It's like, okay, let's just say I have somebody that's totally clean on the table. Everything appears that I would have full relative motion in the entire system. Now I'm going to move you into upright, and I'm going to say, well, can you organize the system to access that relative motion, or is literally the stress of gravity the interference? And so we can, and this also helps us determine our exercise selection, whether we need to take somebody, you know, out of a normal gravity situation, and we can reduce gravity, and we can do that with cables and bands and lying down on the ground and things like that. So again, the complex movements give us a lot of information as to what this person is capable of doing from an exercise selection standpoint. And so we don't have to create a bunch of new tests. We just have to recognize what these movements actually represent. And so we can talk about that.
Right. So yeah, we're trying to get The ERs and IRs and measurements we get on the table are going to sort of tell us what ranges of motion this person has, and more importantly, sort of where they tend to end up within their base of support or outside their base of support when they are compensating, when they are using their behavioral strategies.
Right.
Once we work back those strategies to giving them relative motions on the table, mm-hmm. then what you're saying is we put them upright to put them into like the gravity field, have to stand on two legs and then move mm-hmm. around. And we start to see like where their compensation strategies come up. Because as soon as you put the you put them upright against gravity, there's going to be all of the internal and external forces working together that had them need to come see you to begin with are just all coming back.
Correct.
Movement is a strong behavioral influence, so you're always going to sort of easily revert to your previous tendencies.
Yes.
So they may need some type of assistance or ways to help shift their center of gravity within their base of support to allow them to kind of reorganize and move within a way that's not going to knock them into their compensatory strategy too quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the test that we would use, we've kind of mentioned a couple of them. I think I would also like, I know we don't really look at this typically in the UHPC model, but I think it would be useful to talk about like an upper quarter test, like a scratch test or something.
Very limited value.
Right. So I want to talk about why, because a lot of people are going to want to know, because that is a pretty commonly used test, correct? Like trying to reach over, trying to reach behind my
forever.
Back. Right. So
like Apley,
let's talk about Apley.
I don't know how old Apley is.
But. Right. Also, like, didn't Apley come up with a bunch of different tests? It wasn't just that one.
Yeah.
Anyone that's a knee, PT.
There's a knee test. I think there's a knee test that has.
Yeah. Anyone that's osteopathic, like historian or PT historian can tell us in the comments if they know of any other Apley tests. So the Apley test trying to measure shoulder range of motion. Okay.
Yeah.
What is it? What is it really showing us? Cause it could be useful to see someone try to do this and how they compensate when they try to do it. Right.
Well, yeah, the compensations are infinitely more valuable because I don't know that I've ever seen anybody pass the test. Ever.
So let's talk about why it might not be so useful and why you can't really measure what you're trying to measure in that position.
Well, okay. So I think the misunderstanding is that there is one shoulder that's turning into ER and one shoulder that's turning into IR in that test.
Yeah.
And they're both IR strategies. Like if you could pass it, you're looking at different representations of actually a late IR strategy.
And I think someone might pause for a second when they hear that and be like, what do you mean? So I would usually just tell people to try it, right? So if I reach my right hand up and try over my head and try to touch the outside of my left shoulder blade.
Yeah.
Pay attention. All I need to do is pay attention to the position of my humerus, right?
Yeah. So, okay. So if you reach straight out in front of you, palm up. So, so you're going to externally rotate the shoulder to its maximum degree at shoulder level. And if I hold that ER all the way up, I can't touch the opposite shoulder blade. I actually have to turn into internal rotation to reach by my head, which is IR.
Yeah,
like you're going to turn your hand into IR, you're going to turn your forearm into IR, and the humerus is going to follow into IR to get over to the opposite side.
Right. So, in order to reach either above and across or below and across, you are IRing in both of those.
Yes.
So yeah, so that immediately just takes away the value of what people were using it for. Also, yes. I think
it doesn't reduce value. I think it's just the recognition of what is actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, and it will just be a measurement of how much compensation someone can drive through their neck.
Neck, thorax.
Like
you see somebody sort of thrust their chest forward.
Absolutely.
And they IR the entire spine, and you see the anti-orientation of the scapulae, which which makes the scapula look like it's pulling off of the rib cage to get the arm behind the back. And then you look overhead and you see them thrust their head forward, or you see the inability to actually internally rotate the humerus effectively. It's like there's value in that, because I can definitely tell you that you don't have the capacity for full late internal rotation.
Yeah.
So still useful, just maybe a better understanding.
Right. So it's not an active test for ER and IR, like many people might think.
It is not.
Okay. So that's why we wouldn't necessarily even use it.
If that's the information that you need to glean from an assessment, useful. If not, then maybe if you understand the compensatory strategies that are associated with it, still useful.
Right.
But again, not measuring what you think it might be measuring, I think.
Yeah. And it may be useful as a comparative, as long as you know the compensations you're looking out for, if someone improves. But in understanding also, kind of like we talked about last time, if that test improves, but their measures aren't improving on the table, then there was just some other compensation thrown on.
Yeah, you just magnified a compensatory strategy.
Yeah. So what would be, let's offer an alternative then. If someone's trying to pay attention to like how relative movement is happening in the upper half of the body, the upper quarter of the body, what's a better complex movement, maybe choice
for someone to use? Wall, back to wall, traditional flexion tests.
Right. Something that keeps you in more of that yard position as you do it. And there's videos for this on the network and on Bill's YouTube. So you can look through that. It's a back to wall, like shoulder flexion. Okay. So that's good. We provide an alternative. So you can actually put them in a space to measure from that isn't one of just IR for both directions.
Correct. Yes. You have to maintain the ER. So part of the confusion is not understanding that you're like, people will say, oh, this measures shoulder ER, IR or whatever. You're not just measuring the glenohumeral joint in any circumstance. You've got a humerus, you've got a scapula, you've got a rib cage shape, you've got a spine shape and orientation. You'll have influences from the hand and the forearm that influence the position of the humerus. And it's like, so all of these things need to be resolved, which is why we have the assessment course as it is.
Sure.
So you can actually understand what these influences are. It's like, you could have somebody with a, you know, with an ER going through the entire extremity and an IR hand orientation.
Yep.
Right. That would, again, has to be resolved segmentally first.
Yeah. And I think this is probably a good opportunity to say that we are close to releasing. So by the time anyone watches this, it'll probably be ready to go. But on the UHP network, which is free, you can go there, and we're close to finishing the assessment 101 course, which will go over the major table tests that we've talked about. And we'll also go over these major complex movements we talked about and give you like some pictures and some description on how to utilize them and interpret them. So I don't want to necessarily go through every single one of those, but we're talking about some of the big hitters. Mm-hmm. We did something for like the upper quarter, shoulder range of motion, whatever people are trying to measure with that. Let's talk about probably squats and toe touches. And then I want to talk about gait, people that talk about gait analysis. And I'm making air quotes for everyone listening. Yeah, so the squat, typically used, I've seen it used in a lot of different ways to try to show. A lot of times you'll see someone do like an overhead squat with their arms overhead to try to see like a full display of range of motion. We're looking for compensations there. Well, we're talking about
that constrains the bottom of the test, like right off the bat. It constrains the lowest portion of the test. So it's a great way to induce a compensatory strategy where you see the sort of like the expanded representation of the lumbar spine, which is like, that's a system that's looking for space to descend, right? So that's an ER compensatory strategy by constraining the scapulae into a forward projection, which is what the overhead position is in an overhead squat.
Right. Well, it's a late propulsive position, and the bottom of a squat is an early propulsive.
That is correct. That's why there's a conflict, and that's why you'll see more compensatory strategies. And then And they say, well, but it cleans up when I elevate their heels. Yes, because now you're putting the entire system into a late propulsive strategy. So now you don't have the mismatch between thorax and pelvis in that circumstance, or even the foot for that matter, right? So you're at least you're being coherent with a late propulsive strategy. So of course the movement will look better.
Right. So now let's talk about, so that's a legacy way of testing a squat and why it doesn't really show you the full picture. It gives you a very limited representation of something very specific, but that's not really what people are looking for or looking at.
Yeah.
Is from our perspective. So how would we utilize a squat differently, and what information are we looking to glean from the squat assessment?
So a squat goes from the bottom up as far as its representation goes. So early propulsion is, so here's the requirements. I need enough ER space. So ER creates a space for me to descend into. I need to be able to superimpose internal rotation on that in that space. And it's not maximal internal rotation at the very bottom of a squat. It is the, because early is the first superimposition of internal rotation. I don't need a maximum amount of internal rotation to descend into the deepest possible squat. But I do need enough ER space, and I do need to superimpose some measure of internal rotation. And so if I could compensate and create a big ER compensation, I can have somebody that has crazy limited motion on the table when I start to emphasize certain segments, but yet they could still stand up and perform what would appear to be in many eyes as a very good deep squat. But it's compensatory in that circumstance. So there's the value of understanding table chest versus the complex movements. I could have somebody that appears to have a very deep squat, and they go, oh, look at all the range of motion you have. It's like, oh, and I would say, well, look at all the compensatory strategy that you have, right? And so that understanding becomes much more important, because now what you may accidentally do is load someone in a squatting activity and magnify the strategies, and now you there are consequences to that, where you have stagnation of energy, loads on structure, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so that was squat. Let's talk about, what else did we say we're going to talk about? The toe touch. So typically, I think typically the toe touch is to look at, people are concerned about looking at I don't even know anymore. Like, what I'm trying to remember back to, like, what I was told. What we were looking at, hamstring tightness. Maybe?
Well, people will talk about that, because they'll feel muscle activity and connective tissue tension, you know, when they bend forward. So then, of course, wherever I feel it gets blamed, when it's actually a strategy to try to resist you from doing that.
Right.
So again, you're dealing with muscle activity that. There is similarity between the squat and a toe touch, in the fact that the axial skeletal shapes will follow. So when you initiate a toe touch, you're actually in late propulsion. You're actually moving forward. And then what happens is you slow forward down, and that's where you arrive at the bottom of the toe touch. So we're trying to reduce the influence of the extremity behavior, so we can refine our perspective on whether we have more axial behavior that could be interfering with activity or the lower extremity. And so that's the advantage between those two. So they kind of go hand in hand. We've got two rotation tests that we'll use that in a very similar manner, where we're actually using the extremity. So let's just lead into that. We're doing like a standing rotation test, which would involve the lower extremities. It's an asymmetrical test, which is different from the squat and the toe touch. And so what we get on either side is a differing representation of the phase of propulsion. So the direction that you would turn in a standing rotation test would be towards early propulsion and away from late propulsion, and obviously vice versa. And then if we take you to a seated representation, once again, we're trying to take the extremities out of the equation, so we can actually refine whether we're looking at something that is more axial in origin versus extremity.
Right. So that's an important distinction. I kind of want to repeat that for everyone listening. So the toe touch being an axial representation of what's going on through early, middle, and late propulsion. That's and great. Then a squat is less constrained. The joint, the appendicular skeleton can bend and yes. and turn. Yes. So it's more showing you the whole system moving.
Yeah, with axial plus appendicular in a squat, we have primarily axial and a toe touch.
Right.
We have axial plus appendicular in standing rotations, and then we have more axial in a seated rotation.
Like, right. So it's just zoomed out, zoomed in.
Yeah. It's like what is contributing to whatever degree. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay. So then I think instead of talking about split, I think let's talk about gait, because I talked about it a bit. Mm-hmm. Split squat, we talk about a lot on the network. So it's not an advertisement for that, but in UHP Plus, we have like a case studies. We have case study episodes, which are basically like a podcast series of you and I talking about different case studies.
Yeah.
And we look at a lot of split squats. Yes. So we use that as a way. It's a pretty huge big bang for your buck. Like if I had to just look at one thing complex to someone to do, it'd probably be that and maybe a toe touch. But yeah, anyways, so check that out. A bunch of stuff of that. Like I said, free assessment course going to be available soon. It has a big split squat part in it. So let's talk about walking. Let's talk about what people seem to care about when it comes to like gait analysis and walking. And then I think what people should actually be paying attention to when they watch someone walk.
Well, it is a common representation of all the phases of propulsion. So propulsion is moving forward through space in contact with the medium, right? Sometimes the medium is your own body. Sometimes it's water if you're swimming. Sometimes it's the ground when you're walking. And so what we would expect to see is if we looked at all of our complex movements, we would have a general idea of what this person's capabilities are. And then what we're going to do is we're going to put them in a much more dynamic context where I'm going to see this demonstrated with rate much more influential, because I am moving forward at a very obvious state. And so we could see any differences in, say, foot contacts to the ground, knee orientations. You'll see magnifications of compensatory strategies that would be similar to what we would see in complex movements. I don't think most people, like without having looked at a lot of people walking, benefit a great deal from it, unless you're looking for something in isolation, like again, foot shape, ground contact, you know, something that's specific that showed up in your complex movements. I think it's a little bit easier to use walking for that purpose. Whereas once you've evolved perspective, understand table tests, understand complex movements, and then training your coach's eye, if you will, over time, then I think it has greater value, because it saves a lot of time, because you can watch somebody walk in the door and you can identify a number of things that just become confirmations in your assessment. Right. So, you know, I think people get excited about it, but there's a lot to it, which you can learn in pieces. Again, the table tests give you more emphasis of certain areas. Whereas now you have to try to look at this whole thing moving through space at some rate, which is very hard to see. It's much harder to see.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, when they sign up for like a gait analysis course, they're really paying attention to these like diagnoses that you would see, like Trendelenburg gait, or what are some of the other names that you typically see for in gait analysis for compensation or compensated gait?
Well, you'll see like, you know, like sort of like they would call it like adducted, right? Where there's a lot of movement towards midline, and
or someone like, oh, you walk duck footed, or you're a toe walker. These sort of like really vague diagnoses, right?
Medial and lateral whips, which are just representations of compensatory ERs and IRs, depending on where they show up. And
do the upslips and downslips get talked about a lot in gait?
You probably won't. I mean, you could see it reinforced.
Yeah.
But not necessarily directly. I think one of the biggest things that gets totally ignored is thorax in the upper extremity. Right. It's very difficult to find a book on locomotion that takes the thorax and upper extremity into a great deal of consideration.
Everything is just about the foot and the leg and the pelvis.
Yeah, like most of your, you know, like the EMG stuff is going to be all lower extremity. And that's unfortunate because the thorax becomes a very integral part of what you're going to be seeing in the lower extremity because they're mirrors of what's actually going on.
Yeah. So because we're not really going to be able to answer anyone watching this being like, oh, Bill is going to teach me about gait analysis. It's not really about that. It's more like we're trying to offer the perspective of being able to zoom in and out on movement and movement assessment. So we have like the, just in relating this back and analogizing like the complex movements, you have the zoomed out version, which is the appendicular and axial together. And then you have the zoomed in version, which is the axial representation. The same thing is true with when you're watching someone walk and gait, we will develop based on what we learn and the assessments and what we expect from different movements. We'll develop this sort of eye that you're talking about, coach's eye, for what should be happening as the foot interacts with the ground. The wave of motion of rotation that should go up through the body and then back down through the body. So that understanding that, you know, you have the wheel and the hub. So the pelvis being like the hub of this movement system, and then the wheel being the extremities, and those sort of like lagging behind the movement. So it is complex, and it is a pretty difficult thing to be able to kind of look at without experience or just a general understanding of what is going on and what we expect.
Right. Well, you have to understand what the options are in like an ideal circumstance first, right? Like because if you don't have an expectation of what the options provide, you don't have anything to compare to. Now you might see things, like you might be able to recognize something, but you wouldn't understand it sufficiently, right? So if you see a lateral heel whip in somebody that's walking, that's an IR compensatory strategy through the axial skeleton that's actually creating that, right? If I see a medial heel whip, that's somebody that lacks the late external rotation. It means they'd rather be weight bearing on that leg than trying to propel forward off of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, so there is clarity of understanding, but you have to be able to understand like, what would that table test look like? Okay. Well, what would that look like in a standing rotation test? And then I can say, oh, now I can see how I can recognize this in a much more dynamic environment, like walking, which is, again, it's a very high rate of movement, which makes it more difficult to see. But just like anything else, it's a matter of, it is experiential. You do have to spend time looking at a lot of things, making a lot of comparisons so that you do understand what you're actually seeing.
Right. This, the sum, yeah. Understanding like the 30,000 foot perspective, the sum of the parts, the potential for different places that the compensation is coming from as well. It's like an IR compensatory strategy isn't always going to be addressed at one spot in the body. It could be showing up somewhere else. But understanding the rules, that's kind of why you teach the UHPC model the way you do, where everyone has to understand the principles and concepts first. Because a big problem with all of these biomechanics experts and courses out there is that they're trying to get you to the point of like a veteran experienced practitioner in an 8-week course. And that's literally impossible to do because they're generalizing everything. They're saying that, okay, well, if you see someone walk with this strategy, it's an IR compensation. So they're lacking IR and they need to work on their hip internal rotation. It's like, no, that's probably not right. Maybe that'll get you there. But it's like where it's like understanding N equals one. Each person has their own structural bias, where that person is within their base of support, what movement strategies and behaviors they use to get to that place. Yes. And then it's being able to reorganize that person to move forward with them instead of just giving everyone the same exact three exercises to try to get IR back, creating with 90% of those people creating another compensatory strategy on top of the ones that they already had. And then, you know, washing your hands of it if it doesn't work. Just blame it on somebody. Kick the can down the road to somebody else. Okay. I think we accomplished what we were trying to accomplish. What do we got to do a question? I don't know. No one really answered the last one. So I don't know if anyone's watching to the end again. If you're watching, leave a comment on YouTube because it helps drive traffic. And it also lets us know that people are actually watching to the end. I want to know people's coffee orders. Like, what do you order when you go to the coffee shop? How ridiculous is your order? Is it like,
I have no idea.
Well, because I mean, I usually do very simple. I have very simple orders. I'll do like a flat white with cinnamon.
I don't even know what that means. See, I don't even know what a flat white means.
It's all about the ratio. Culture. It's all about the ratio of foam to milk when it comes to these like lattes, flat whites, cortados, macchiatos.
Yeah, I know how to make my own coffee.
Right. You push a button and water comes through the beans.
It goes through the stuff and then it makes coffee. Yeah.
Right. And you get all those beautiful microplastics.
Try it.
That's what creates longevity, right?
There's preservatives, right?
Yeah. There you go. Preserving. Okay. So yeah, leave your coffee order. More complicated, the better. I want to hear someone's like, 9-ingredient coffee order from Starbucks that ends up being $13. Those are my favorite. It's like you went to get a coffee that was $13. That's impressive.
People think walking's complicated. It's like some of these coffee orders are kind of ridiculous.